it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's Southeast Asia seminar. And our speaker is Roger Montgomery. He used to be part of the LSE at the Asia Research Center and is now more or less freelance.
Yes.
But he is one of our foremost experts on things like agriculture, deforestation in Southeast Asia more broadly, but specifically in Indonesia. And today he's going to be speaking about deforestation, El Nino and reforestation under the provocative title of Borneo Burning, which I assume all of you have spotted in the news at some point. Over to you, Roger.
Thank you. As Kirsten mentioned, I was for 6 years at the Asia Research Center, and one of the reasons I'm not there anymore is that it is not there anymore. It has been broken up into this center for Southeast Asia and another center for South Asia and one for East Asia. But I've tried to keep in contact. Our understanding of deforestation, I've got some good news and some bad news, so I might as well get the bad news out of the way first. The bad news is that deforestation is back with a vengeance. After a period in which we thought it had rapidly decreased, it's been going on for a long time. The first person to really make a big noise and to alarm people about how serious the deforestation was the late Derek Holmes, my colleague and friend who used to work for Hunting Technical Services, the consulting firm that I worked with. Derek took the 1985 Reprot maps. Reprot was a series of maps designed for transmigration, but they mapped the entire country. And it was done by a British bunch based in Greenwich, ODNRI, Natural Resources Institute. Derek took the 1985 information, which was largely, that was before satellite imagery was available. It was largely aerial photos, a few satellite images, various soil studies, land use studies, whatever was available, and tried to map Indonesia and find out where the forest was, the remaining forest. The objective was to try to send transmigrants. This was during the period of transmigration out of Java onto the other islands, not to places with virgin forest. So you had to find where the forest was. In 1997, the first real inventory of Indonesia's forests was undertaken. So Derek took these two sources, where the forest was in 1985 and where it was in 1997, and came up with some alarming numbers that Indonesia was losing 1.7 million hectares of forest a year. Now, what's a hectare? Now, people in this country still often use acres. A hectare is Arsenal's plus Chelsea's plus Tottenham's football fields. Roughly. If a football field is about 100 meters long and about 35 meters wide, I guess. If you add those three, that's a hectare. And Indonesia was losing 1.7 million hectares. And another group actually mapped the same data. Is this big enough? See? Can you see? Maybe we should go to full screen. Okay. How in the world do we do that with this thing? Okay. This was the loss from 1985 to 1997. It's basically showing on a map exactly what Derek had shown here. The rate of deforestation declined around the beginning of this century down to 300,000-500,000 hectares a year, much below what it was before. And everyone was becoming rather happy that things had finally begun to improve. But the most recent information is that the rate of deforestation is back up around 2 million hectares a year. And the deforestation can take a number of different forms. One is if there's still any valuable timber, obviously the developer, usually an oil palm plantation, but also another culprit is pulp and paper mills, will take out the remaining valuable forests, the beautiful dipterocarps, the two-winged seed. That's what dipterocarp means. The seed has two wings and the helicopter's down and lands somewhere else. But the most alarming information is that it's back up around 2 million hectares a year. Well, this is one of the two culprits. This is pulp and paper plywood supply in Sumatra. And we'll come to the fires in just a minute. This shows the imbalance throughout the 1990s between installed capacity for pulp and paper and the sustainable yield from the actual forest. And the worst provinces were Riau and Jambi. This shows basically the estimate of what, on a sustained basis, the forest could yield. Well, the pulp and paper people simply wanted a lot more. The newest information, and this is really super information, this is done by Matthew Hansen, who used to be at South Dakota and is now at the University of Maryland. He and a group of people, including Robin Burgess of this university, as one of their participants, but it was mostly Matthew Hansen and his people who really understood how to use Landsat data, gathered all of the Landsat data, all of the Landsat images, for a 12 or 13 year period, for the entire world, and processed them to try to measure forest loss. It took a tremendous amount of computing capacity. Fortunately, Google company offered the services of the cloud for literally for free. It's Earth Engine with all of these linked computers all around the world, and they were actually able to process this. And this fantastic map, this appeared in an article in Science in 2013, and you can access it yourself. Each dot, each little dot is a pixel of change in color signal showing the change in land use and loss of forest. And you notice that throughout Asia, the biggest loss is Indonesia compared to anywhere else. There are some losses in China and various other places. And you can focus in on this, and later when we get to the good news, we'll show how you can focus in on any island, and you could keep changing the scale, and you don't lose any clarity because each little red dot is 30 meters by 30 meters. It's the pixel is that accurate to measure the change. Well, this is the change in over the decade, 2000 to 2013. The losses, you can see the losses in Kalimantan are basically here in central Kalimantan and west Kalimantan and various areas of the northern parts here. And the losses of the forest in Sumatra, they are tremendous. There have been some gains, there have been some plantings, and this is the gains. Now, to call this a gain in forest, you really have to be a bit careful about this, because what this is mostly planting of oil palm. This is not forest. This is planting of trees, and oil palm is a tree, but it does not offer any most of the services that a forest would offer. And we'll come to those in just a minute. Also, if you compare the two, you can see that there are so many more red dots. There's so much more loss than there is in terms of gains. And there was one source said that, here it is, when Matthew Hansen and his group came out with their findings in the maps, around the entire world, the world lost 888,000 square miles. This was an American one, so they went to miles instead of kilometers. And in the same period, only 300,000 hectares of forest were gained. This past year has been even worse. It has been a year of El Nino, and much of the loss of the forest every year is through burning. And who's doing the burning? There's a lot of finger pointing at the large oil palm investors, a lot at the pulp and paper people, a lot at smallholders, a lot at illegal transmigrants. Everybody's doing the burning. Normally, the fires for land clearing, if it's a rather useless patch of land with only secondary scrub and brush and nothing of any real value, there are many ways that land could be cleared for agriculture, but the cheapest and the most damaging is, of course, just to set it on fire. Now, the fires are normally set just to burn and clear the land. Even smallholders do this a lot too. Just one or two weeks before the rains come, because it's the rains that put out the fires every year. Indonesia does not have firefighters the way, say, California or parts of Australia. I mean, that's a very expensive operation, that kind of firefighting, with helicopters and airplanes that pick up vast volumes of water and drop it. Indonesia cannot afford that. Most developing countries cannot afford that at all. But this year has been a particularly bad year. Why? Because this has been an El Nino year. And so for just a couple of minutes here, I'd like to go into an explanation of what is an El Nino and what is the impact. And to understand that, understand an El Nino, you have to be able to answer a couple of the simplest questions. That when I first arrived at Cornell University in 1968 to start as a postgraduate student, my professor asked me some of the simplest questions in the world, and I could not answer them. I just had no idea. The first question was, what direction does the wind blow in Indonesia at any particular time of the year? What's a monsoon? Why does the wind blow? Why doesn't it just give up and go home and put up its feet and have a cup of tea and watch the BBC? Why does the wind blow? What causes the wind to blow? Because it's the wind that brings the rain, right? So if we don't understand why the wind blows, then we won't understand why it rains or why it doesn't rain. Normally, in our latitudes, in the temperate zone, our weather systems come from the west. They don't come as straight lines. There's never a straight line in motion on this earth, by the way. Newton's first law of motion actually doesn't hold. Newton had three laws of motion, right? The first one was about motion, the second one was about acceleration, and the third was about action and reaction. The first law said that if an object has obtained a certain velocity, it will continue in that straight line. Well, that can't happen here on the earth because we have gravity. So it's just not possible. The second part is that the laws of motion on a rotating disk are actually quite complicated. They were first described by, and he has about five or six, seven names. I can't remember them all, but Count Gustav the Coriolis, writing from Paris in about 1835, described the laws of motion on a rotating disk. And we're on a rotating disk. We just happen to be on a three-dimensional version of it, but to simplify it, the laws of motion on a rotating disk are that everything is curvilinear. Everything curves. Nothing will go straight when you're sitting on a rotating disk. And so the winds that we see, the every morning we watch the BBC, the weather forecasters, they either rotate clockwise or they rotate counterclockwise according to whether they're high pressure or low pressure. That doesn't hold near the equator. Between the two tropics, our wind, the wind that, let's say that we start with the sun right over the equator on the solstice, right? On the equinox, when the sun is right over the equator, the wind comes from the east. If you're a sailor, sailors always knew this, but we don't have sailors anymore. Every ship seems to have a motor, so nobody tries to figure out which way the wind is blowing. There are three places in the world that you don't want to be sailing when the sun is right over the equator. You don't want to be sailing at the latitude of Cuba, because those are the horse latitudes. There's no wind. There's essentially no wind at all. It's around, 25, somewhere between 25 and 30 degrees north. You don't want to be sailing right near the equator because there's no dominant wind. You want to be between the two at about 10 to 15 degrees north. Then there's a very strong wind that goes straight from the coast of the Americas towards Indonesia. And that's the northern trade wind. And it was called trade wind because the trading vessels got to about that latitude and felt the strong wind, and off they went. You could sail any direction as long as you had a strong wind. And then there's a southern one that comes at the mirror image just south of the equator. Well, during an El Nino, what happens is that these masses actually, the masses of air, starting here in the Americas, come all the way across, unimpeded, all the way to Southeast Asia, one here and one coming this direction. And they pick up moisture the entire way that as they're crossing the ocean. And then the two trade winds basically come together and converge at an area called the intertropical convergence zone, where there's almost no movement of wind at all. The two winds slow down, come together, and then they go straight up into the air. Why? Because it's very hot, and the heat causes convection, and when all this moist air goes straight up into the air, what does it do? It rains. And that's what causes the rainy season. Now, this event of this convergence between these two winds actually has to move north and south as the Earth tilts towards the sun, the southern hemisphere or the northern hemisphere. The whole event has to move north and south. And during a typical rainy season, it's this northern trade wind that comes and curves because of the Coriolis effect. It has to curve and it has to start heading back down. And it drops all of its rain over Indonesia. When there's an El Nino, unfortunately, the Pacific Ocean gets hotter out here in the eastern part. Normally, the western part of the Pacific is much warmer water than the eastern part of the Pacific. But for some reason, and this I don't understand myself, my field is agricultural economics, actually. But I had to learn something about the weather, because if you're going to do agriculture, you have to understand why it rains and when it rains. During an El Nino, it gets very, very warm out here. And this shows the deviation from the average, that this part becomes very, very warm. Well, this is dangerous, because those winds that had been picking up moisture drop it out here. They drop a lot of the rainfall here and arrive much drier in Indonesia. And that's an El Nino. And the best source on this is, if you really want to understand it, is to go to NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration of the U.S. They're the ones who produce these beautiful maps and diagrams. And if you are a bit of a dunderhead about this stuff like me, go to the Lessons for School Kids section and start right at the very bottom to understand. Well, what happened this year? People lit fires, and they didn't go out. The rains didn't come. The rains were very, very late. They brought much less water than normally. It has started raining, and most of the fires are out now. But the El Nino is not over. And that El Nino effect, remember the big climate talks in Paris in November and December? And everybody was worried about the average Earth temperature rising only 1 or 2 degrees. Well, that's what happens here during an El Nino. It only has to rise 2 degrees. The water temperature only has to rise 2 degrees for us to get an El Nino. And it rains out over the Pacific. It dumps all of the moisture here. Here's the actual precipitation. This was a terrible El Nino. And my wife and I were in Indonesia during this one, 1997-98. It rains like mad out here. And therefore, this is the deviation from normal, is it rains here, and it's very, very dry here. And that's all of Southeast Asia. It's not just Indonesia. When these fires start, they are just uncontrollable. And unfortunately, the direction of the wind is such that the smoke, because these are the trade winds, they take the smoke to the west, to the northwest, up towards Malaysia and Singapore. If ever the smoke from these fires could reach Jakarta, you could be sure that there would be some action. The government would do something. But because they never hit Jakarta, they only hit Singapore and Malaysia, they make the people in Singapore and Malaysia angry. Really angry, because the damage that's done, airline flights are canceled, kids can't go to school, businesses are closed, workers get sick, all kinds of things. And various people have done estimates of the damages here. Where was it? The Asian Development Bank did an estimate. Their estimate, I think, was $15 billion worth of, here it is, yeah. $15 billion worth of damage to all kinds of activities. The Indonesian government itself did one. Here's an alarming article from late October in the Jakarta Globe, an English language paper, that the estimate, Indonesia's own estimate, was $35 billion worth. That takes care of all growth in Indonesia this year, is that loss. But much of the loss was to people in Singapore and Malaysia. It was not experienced entirely by Indonesia. And an enormous number of people also in hospital and respiratory problems. Quite a number died. What can be done about this? Another aspect of these El Niños is that they're getting more and more frequent. They used to occur about every 4 or 5 years. That you would have a very, very dry year in Indonesia, and you'd lose a good part of a rice crop. most recently, it looks as though they've been occurring almost every 2 years. To have an El Nino, then when an El Nino hits, these are the part areas of the world. It's not just Indonesia that gets hit. It has a very negative impact on lots of different regions in the world, depending on the time of the year. If it's when this trade wind is dominant, this whole area becomes very, very dry. Australia, Eastern Australia experiences all kinds of fires. Well, it led to tremendous anger in Singapore and Malaysia, there's been so many news articles about it, I really can't keep up with them all. It's just alarming. But finally, in Singapore, the Singapore authorities actually went into the local offices of some of these oil palm companies and pulp and paper companies and just started arresting whoever they could find. Just arrested officials saying, your company is causing us this damage. We can't get to Jakarta to arrest your bosses in Jakarta, but we'll arrest you. That finally sent the wind up people. What can be done is, number one, there are alternative ways of clearing land. If not beautiful forest, but just scrub and brush, there's a very simple chemical way of using a relatively safe, it's called pesticide. It's called Roundup. It's glyphosate, not the dangerous ones like Gramoxone, which are more effective but very, very dangerous to people. But glyphosate, Roundup, is fairly, gardeners use it all the time without killing each other. And there are mechanical ways of doing it. And there are vegetative control mechanisms also that can control many of the noxious weeds that are there. But the cheapest so far is still fire. So until the government really becomes serious about arresting people, Indonesia's own people, for starting the fires, then we're still going to be having this problem. It's what could be done would be to at least to alert the population as early as possible. This is an El Nino year. Don't start fires. If you start a fire, you're going to be arrested because those fires are not going to go out. And in fact, this El Niños normally start around June or July. This one was detected as early as March. And there are a group of us who watch Indonesia's forests, and I have a sort of an email network. It's called the Billboard, if any of you want to join it and receive them. It's from a guy named Bill Collier who lives in Bogor. If you'd like to receive the emails, he can just add your name to his list. And we're sending out interesting articles to each other, you know, about what's going on, what's happening, what does the press say, which is how I found a lot of this material. Was fortunately somebody just sent it to me as part of the Billboard, the discussion group. One of the things that became clear was that this El Nino started very early in March, so we all started talking about it, and everybody who was in Indonesia tried to alert the government. But the government didn't pay much attention, so anyway, we're left with a heck of a problem. Well, that's the bad news, and we can come back to that if you'd like to have a bit more of a discussion or what I know. Everything that I know about this is secondary. Sitting here in London, I have no ability to really do any original research into this part of the problem. I instead decided to turn my attention to a different issue. There are so many people watching and monitoring and reporting and discussing the loss of the forest. When will people plant a tree? What do you have to do to get people to plant trees? What are the conditions? What kind of project activities can you undertake to get people to plant trees? As it turned out, a number of years ago, I was asked by the Australians to go out and do an independent external evaluation of a bunch of grants that they'd made to small NGOs, non-governmental organizations, charities, the usual term in this country, I think, like Oxfam or Save the Children, those kinds of, and many of them are also local Indonesian NGOs. And during the evaluation, we found one NGO that had actually working with farmers on the island of Timor, a dry, desolate, way out of the way place. This one group had planted 8.5 million trees. They had actually, working with the farmers, they'd gotten them to plant 8.5 million trees with an 82% survival rate. And you do have to measure the survival rate, too, because foresters are not like farmers. Foresters go out and plant trees and then walk away and come back 8-10 years later to see if they got anything. Farmers will go back and weed if weeds are invading, or do something about insects if a pest starts attacking, or rats or something of that sort. But foresters don't. But this particular group did. So I thought it would be an interesting topic. How did they, working with these farmers, how did they get them to plant 8.5 million trees? Well, there are a couple of lessons of this. One is, don't go out and try to tell people to plant trees, especially poor people. The poorer the participant is, the shorter his or her time horizon. Time is really important. You can make money by planting trees, but you would have to be able to wait 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, depending on what it is that you're going to take from planting the trees. Fruit trees, even the fast-growing fruit trees, are still 3, 4, 5 years. You can't get poor people to wait that long. So what this particular NGO did, here's where I'm talking about. The western half of the island of Timor, the eastern half is Timor-Leste, the independent country. But some people actually sneaked across the border from East Timor to participate in this. So this particular group's activities are even having an international impact, and we'll see that in just a minute. Most people don't even know where the border is in many of these areas, and there are no guard posts or fences or any of that sort of stuff. This particular NGO, working out here on the island of Timor, and right there. Oops. Now what have I done? Basically, you correctly used participatory methods to try to sit down in village meetings. And the NGO community is very familiar with how to use participatory methods. It's called PRA, Participatory Rural Appraisal. And it's a way of getting people to try to define their problems and get them involved in finding the solutions to their own problems. They can't always find 100% of the solutions. I mean, there is a role for outside information, science and technology, but it's basically to get them to sit down and try to find out, why are we so poor? Well, through this participatory method, they actually found that the biggest problems were malnutrition, very low farm gate prices for their products, and high interest rates, money lending on a level that you just can't imagine. If you want just some evidence of how poor this area is, this is one of the poorest areas in the world. I mean, this rivals sub-Saharan Africa in the most landlocked countries. And this is only 4 islands to the east of Bali, which is as opulent and upmarket as anything you can imagine. Bali is extremely wealthy. And the evidence, there's quantitative and qualitative evidence, if you want it, about how poor they are. You can look at the scores on the Millennium Development Goals. Poverty is not just lack of income. Poverty, there are many, many aspects of poverty. One is malnutrition, child malnutrition. Another is maternal mortality, especially during childbirth. Educational achievement, enrollment rates, gender equality, balance in education. There are a lot that you could use. Well, I just focused in the paper just to try to demonstrate how poor these people are. I looked at child malnutrition in particular. The malnutrition problem in the Eastern Islands, in the Nusa Tenggara Islands, got so bad by the beginning of this century that in certain areas they actually had to call in the World Food Program and ask for assistance from WFP in things that are very familiar in other parts of the world, basically food for work type programs, like the World Food Program used to do in a great big way in Bangladesh and parts of India and lots of other countries. WFP is geared up for this and knows how to run it. And among the things that World Food Program does, when it first comes in, it goes around and does nutritional studies. In fact, health studies of all aspects of health. one of the, and when I read their health report, one of the things that alarmed me the most was about 25% of the people actively have malaria. The rate of incidence of malaria in these islands is very alarming. I mean, to the point that I started taking malaria pills. I hadn't been thinking of taking malaria pills when I went. But in the year 2002, using data from the BPS, you can see that almost this entire island, the half of the island, was suffering from malnutrition by their definitions. A number of years later, after not just assistance from WFP, but also by the fact that people finally started growing a lot more food through new agricultural technologies. This is the most recent food insecurity map by the World Food Program. And yes, there are still some areas of major concern right down the backbone of the island, but many of the other areas of the island of Timor, the incidence of malnutrition is much, much less. In fact, the area that now is of greatest concern is the next island over, Sumba, which is a real problem area. Well, when you try to figure out why are these people so poor, you have to distinguish constraints from risks. Constraints are things that are just there and you can't do anything about. Risk you can reduce, or you try to find ways of reducing risk, but if you're faced with a constraint, you basically have to adjust your strategy to live with the constraint. It's always there. And as part of the participatory method, rather than going immediately towards trying to change the agricultural technology, introduce new crops, introduce tree crops, things of that sort, the NGO worked with the villagers to solve their most important problems first. And the number one problem was high interest rates, money lending. That's the bank. Yeah, on the island of Lombok, it's called Bank Selamat Pagi. Good morning. How are you? Huh? Bank Rontok, also it's called. You don't go to the bank comes to you. The bank comes first thing. They lend you 100,000 rupees today. Tomorrow morning they'll be there. Please pay 4,000 rupees every day for 30 days. 4,000 or 5,000 rupees. And they come and you must pay. And the interest rates that they're charging, on Java it's called Bank Pelicit, which is squeeze dry bank, like squeezing a lemon dry. These banks charge 20 to 30% a month, not a year, a month. 30% a month, uncompounded, comes out to 360% a year. There's nothing that you can invest in. No project that's going to return enough to pay off that kind of loan. If it's compounded at 30% a year, it comes out to around 3,000% a year. Which is, by the way, just about equal to Wonga's interest rate in this country before the public started going after Wonga. Wonga now is, and the ones that you see on TV only charge 1,500% a year. I used to think that the Indonesian moneylenders were the highest interest rate in the world until I started watching Wonga's ad. When Wonga had those cartoon characters, those old, nice old couples discussing where to go get some money. You'll never get out of poverty if you have to pay that kind of interest rate. Who's behind it? Now that is an interesting subject. If somebody is looking for a thesis subject, a thesis topic, that would be a really good one. The scuttlebutt from the villages themselves, they said, and I don't want to get in trouble here. I can't vouch for this. I tried to find their office. I asked where their office was. Nobody knew where their office was. It was the Army Pension Fund. The Indonesian Army's Pension Fund is the money lender, is the source of the cash for this rapacious, squeeze-dry money lending. Dana Pension Abri. I tried to find their office. I asked where I wanted to walk in and see what they were up to, but nobody knew where their office was. They just seemed to operate by motorcycle going around. And it's the bank that comes to you. You don't go into the bank. It comes to you. Well, what did they do? This one is popular and has been successful under lots of different projects and programs. Started a little lending and saving and lending associations. get the villagers to sit down together and lend each other money at a much more reasonable rate of interest. And they decide what the rate of interest is, 2% a month, 3% a month, in this particular group's project areas. They tried 5% a month, but they couldn't sustain it, so they agreed on 3%. And people finally started getting out of debt. It's a wonderful story. In fact, I was sitting in the NGO's office one day when down came the Ibu Elizabeth. She seemed to like the name of the queen, so her parents called her Elizabeth. In all of her finest jewelry and so forth, and the head of the NGO had told her, look, your little savings and lending group is handling so much money that you really must go get registered. Go down to the cooperative's office and register as a cooperative, so that somebody can supervise you and watch your books and so forth. This group had accumulated $8,000 worth of cash. People who were always in debt before, the amount of money that they had accumulated. And there are a couple of secrets to this. One is that the head of the NGO and the head of the savings and lending group never touch the money. Once a month, the group comes together and they put all the money that everybody pays into the... And in the paper, I show a little model of how these things grow. There's a little growth model that shows just how quickly a small group of, say, 50 members charging each other 3% a month can actually accumulate a capital fund. So she went in to register, and these people that in these particular villages in Timor that are described in the paper here, actually, most of them are out of debt and now having to go down and register their groups as a small sort of credit union. They're really operating on credit union principles. The second major problem, well, this is a constraint. This is not a risk. This is a constraint, is that these islands are very hilly, and most of the farmers are farming very, very steeply sloping land. Now, that is trouble. The best land to farm is flat land or gently rolling land. If it's flat, you could even plant rice if you had enough water. If it's gently rolling, you could plant most field crops, maize, cassava, soybeans, peanuts, things of that sort. But once you start working a piece of land like this, even though it's very, very dry on the island of Timor, there is a rainy season. It's about 2 or 3 months long. And when it rains, too much rain comes down. And if you're farming a steep slope like this, it will just wash your topsoil away. And you have to move every year, which is why this is an area of shifting cultivation. They just cannot defend their topsoil with their their technology of agriculture that they were practicing. Well, this is the man who led the group, who is still the leader. That's Vincentius Nurag. He actually he won a couple of prizes. He didn't win the Nobel Prize. Maybe we should nominate him for the Nobel Prize, but he did win a second level prize called the Equator Prize. It's a United Nations thing. I'd never heard of it before he won it. One of the Australians nominated him and wrote a letter to the UN, and he got a chance to go to New York and address the General Assembly. He can't speak English. So they had to send an interpreter from the project office along with him to New York. But he got a chance to go to New York. This man had never even been to Jakarta, the national capital. one of the secrets of success of this particular group is that he's from that area and he speaks the local language. And his father was a farmer. But he is an agricultural university graduate. And he also won the nation's highest environmental prize. It's called the Kalpataru. Kalpataru is the tree of life. It's a mythical tree, and there are depictions of the Kalpataru tree on some of the buildings around Borobudur. I googled it and found that there is. It is probably the Bo tree, the tree under which the Buddha was enlightened, which is a ficus religiosa, the religious fig tree. Anyway, he won a couple of prizes, and I think he was part of the delegation, the Indonesian delegation to the climate discussions in Paris. Well, his group, remember earlier we saw the pictures of those maps of the plantings, where people are planting. This is focusing right in just on the island of Timor. We're right in the middle of Timor. This
area here is actually part of a little enclave, part of East Timor. And the border with East Timor is over there. Every time you see a little blue dot here, that is recent plantings. And these are the villages. These are the areas where Vincentius and his little NGO, it's called YMTM, Yayasan Mitra Tani Mandiri, the Foundation for Partnership with Independent Farmers or something like that. Those are the plantings. You can actually see them from the satellite imagery. And they actually add up to 8.5 million trees. How did they do it? Right, this is what is typical. This is slash and burn. All throughout Southeast Asia, you'll find slash and burn farming, able to farm the land only 1 year or 2 years and then having to shift. So slash and burn is basically part of shifting cultivation. This is a typical pattern of a farmer before adopting the new technology. In 1 year, he would plant, each of these is about a third of a hectare. He would plant something. The next year, he'd move to the second plot, a third plot, a fourth plot, fifth plot. And after 5 years of letting the land rest, fallow, he's finally able to come back to the original piece of land again. But the topsoil is very, very thin. It really very low yielding, unproductive. And people just were not able to produce enough food for their own needs. With Project, this is what was introduced. This is a fantastic contour system. It's called SALT, Sloping Agricultural Land Technology. It uses contours. What's the advantage of the contours? This isn't terracing. It's not like rice terracing. It's not leveling and so forth. It's basically just installing rows of something here, or perhaps with a little bit of a ditch, very often with a little bit of a ditch on the contour. The advantage of the ditches and these plantings, of these are little legume trees, trees or bushes, is that it slows down the movement of the water. It, especially if you have a little bit of a ditch every 10 meters or so here, it slows down. And the water coming down in the heavy rains may actually overtop, but it starts at zero velocity. It doesn't just wash straight down the hill. And this happens to actually use Philippine terms rather than Indonesian terms. Ipul Ipul is Lem Toro. It's Lucina, Lucosavala. It's a little legume bush, a great little bush. Gliricidia is Gamal in Indonesian. These are also legumes. They're nitrogen-fixing legumes. Their roots actually fix and add nitrogen to the soil and enrich the soil, and livestock love to eat the leaves. And so you've got a crop that is actually slowing down the movement of the water, slowing down the erosion, adding nitrogen to the soil, and providing livestock feed, because there are a lot of cattle around this part of the world. And in between, this technology was actually devised not by agricultural scientists, there's a whole network of rice institutes and wheat and maize. I used to work for the Wheat and Maize Research Institute. Nobody in any of the agricultural research institutes, international research institutes, designed this. This was designed by a bunch of American Baptist missionaries on the island of Mindanao in the southern Philippines. Now it's really something for somebody who's been slash and burn, shifting around, to suddenly switch to adopting sedentary agriculture such as this. I mean, that is a tremendous technical change, and people are very worried about that kind of stuff. What if this doesn't work? How will we eat? We've never seen this before. We're very nervous about this. But the beauty of what this particular NGO did was that they gradually introduced this. Over one last final rotation around a slash and burn cycle. And the second thing that they did was they introduced trees, not just these little legume trees, but where the food crops are planted in between, in the alleys, they also encourage them to plant trees, timber trees, or fruit trees. So I give a better, I hope better description of how the whole thing worked in here, in the paper. This is
This is the WITH project technology. In the first year, in the first plot, they plant their food crops. They open, they cut or somehow clear the plot, and they plant their food crops. But they have already installed the legume bushes along the contours. And they also plant some other kind of tree, such as one of the most popular choices was cashew nuts. Cashews do very, very well in a very dry climate like this. Cashews demand a very dry climate, in fact. And they can farm that piece of land for 2 or 3 or 4 years because the slope has been stabilized by the introduction of the contour system. And the only reason that they move on to the next plot is the cashew trees start coming up and start shading any food crops. And they because of too much shade, then they have to move to the next plot. So they move to another plot. Another tree species that's very, very popular in this area is mahogany. Now, mahogany is an exogenous species. It's from South America. It's not from the area. But on the other hand, it does grow well in this kind of dry climate. There is mahogany all around. There's some old mahogany up around Atambua that's been there a long time. So they know that mahogany will work. And it's very marketable. And it grows very quickly. 12 to 15 years, you can get a tree this big. To grow a tree this big in this climate takes 30 years. Why? Because we have winter. And everything shuts down for 6 months of the year. Everything stops growing. The actual period in which anything can grow is really quite limited by the weather. But this area doesn't have winter. So the trees can basically grow three times as fast. Instead of 120 days guaranteed frost-free growing cycle, they've got 365 days of guaranteed frost-free growing. In another plot, they've left plot A and plot B and for food crops. They're working on plot C, but the trees are still growing in A and B. Candlenut, Khmeri. It's a nut that we don't know here in the West. It doesn't make it this far, but it's very, very popular in Indonesia. And it used to be a squeeze for oil. For making candles, but it's much cheaper to use other things to make candles these days. But it's still used as a spice, a condiment, and so forth, and it's a very popular tree. After several years, they move on to the fourth plot, and finally to the fifth plot. And what I did was I did a little benefit cost model. I tried to simplify it, just to show how much are they investing. It does take some time and effort to do all of that, that contouring. So that's an investment. Fortunately, it's not a cash investment. These people very often don't have any cash in their pocket. But it is an investment of time. So for any economists in the audience, I knew there wouldn't be a single one. Why won't anybody study economics anymore? This is supposed to be the London School of Economics. Talks like this, I never meet an economist. So if you want to see how benefit cost works, it's a very simple a benefit cost model that does just this. It sort of compares the without project, what people were doing before with the with project, and what are the costs and the benefits. And the benefits are astoundingly large compared to the cost. And the cost is really only some human labor at the beginning to install the contour system. What's it look like in the field? Here are a couple of pictures. These are the little legume, and that's the actual slope. These are the legume bushes that have just been recently planted, these little legume trees, with some extra brush along here, whatever it can be put down to slow down the movement of the water. This is a similar one that I found. This one is almost forming terraces, and this particular one has a bunch of grasses along the top here, too, but always along the contour. It's the contour element that is to slow down the movement of the water. What are the benefits of growing trees? Well, actually, there are lots of different kinds of benefits that we can think of. The first one, and the one that has to be the most important, is income. We may have lots of environmental considerations and things that we think are very, very important, but if it doesn't raise these people's incomes, they're not going to adopt it. So the number one goal has to be income. And it doesn't mean that income has to increase. It could be stabilizing incomes to cope with bad years, such as El Nino years, years of when your food crops fail. It could be the stability of income, but in fact, in this particular case, incomes do really jump the value of the production, and it's so much more diverse from so many different kinds of products now, with from candle nuts and some harvesting of timber and livestock feed that you can actually sell to your neighbors. Many different sources of income. So it's diversification of the income. But the reason that most of us sitting in this room are interested in planting trees is because trees sequester carbon. Carbon sequestration. It takes the carbon out of the air. Planting trees because of the contour system and because of the almost closed canopy coverage. Reduces rapid runoff down the hill of the water. It reduces erosion, and the rapid runoff often causes flooding downstream to somebody else. Erosion causes problems to people downstream. It fills up irrigation canals, fills up drainage ditches, causes flooding and various other things. So many of the benefits that we can think of planting trees are unfortunately what we have to call externalities. They accrue to somebody else. We, sitting here in London, enjoy cleaner air with not so much carbon. The farmers sitting there in Timor don't care about carbon sequestration. We care about it, but they don't. So in the benefit cost model that I did here, I counted only those benefits that accrue directly to the farmers. Not any of the other environmental benefits that accrue to other people off-site. Because that's our tendency is always to look for those benefits to justify, but the people won't plant the trees, they won't adopt the system unless their own income, their own welfare increases. Carry on here a bit. Just to show you a bit of when you introduce agroforestry such as this, the sloping agricultural land technology, you do have to spend some effort, and this is where the NGO used some of the money from the Australians, to help set up nurseries, seedling nurseries, help people to make that investment in growing the tree seedlings, both for the legume trees and for the eventual fruit trees or timber trees. So this... the picture on the left, these are my pictures that I took as we went around to see what they were doing. The one on the left is a nursery for mahogany seedlings, and the one on the right is cashews. These are my colleagues, and this is what cashew actually looks like. That's a cashew fruit, that red thing. And is it clear? Maybe it's not. It's a great big thing that's absolutely useless, with a little nut hanging on the bottom of it. The big red part, the pulpy part, in fact, is really sort of dangerous if you're trying to husk these and get the nut off, and because it will burn, eventually it has a bit of an acid and will burn your hands. So you really have to be very careful about how you process these. And in fact, most of the processing of Indonesia's and the world's cashews is done by sending the whole fruit, the big red pulpy part and the little nut, sending the whole thing to India. India is just the cheapest and the most efficient processor of cashews. Plus, the Indian government subsidizes the processing industry because it hires so many women. That it really makes much more sense to just send your whole fruit to India and have it processed there and then sold on to the market somewhere else. The trees, and I don't want to talk much longer here because I want to give a chance for some question and answers here. Among the trees, the kinds of trees, there were some native species that people are planting also. They're planting lontar palms. It's a palmyra palm. It's a great big fan palm. That's very popular for a number of reasons, one of which is when it grows, you can climb up it, tap it, and take off the sap, and within about an hour or two, it's about 10% alcohol. Tuwak, called Chuba in the southern Philippines, Tuwak in this area. It's very high in sugar content. But the wonderful thing is that some people are actually planting sandalwood trees. Now, anyone who plants a sandalwood tree is not thinking about their own income. They're not thinking about their children's income. They're thinking about their grandchildren. Because sandalwood takes a very long time to grow. in a forest, sandalwood takes between 45 and 90 years. So you really have to be thinking about future generations of your family, not what's going to happen to you yourself. But in all the years that I've been going around on various projects around these eastern islands, I'd never seen a sandalwood tree. So much of eastern islands sandalwood is just gone. It's been harvested, stolen, sold, and nobody would plant it because it takes so long. But I finally saw a sandalwood tree, and there it is. Somebody actually planted a sandalwood tree. I was sitting in the office of this sub-district head in one of the districts on the island of Timor, and I just looked out the window, and I said, "What's that tree? I've never seen that tree before." And he said, "That's it. That's Chandana. That's sandalwood. They're actually planting sandalwood," which is really quite something. Well, and my last slide here, I've got just some of the economics of what are the costs and what are the benefits and what are the rates of return. But since there isn't an economist in the room, then I won't go into this very much. But the numbers are not large for any family, just in the hundreds of dollars, the difference between what they're getting now compared to what they were getting before. But it's enough for these people to convince them to adopt this. And what's the proof that this actually worked? The Australian government gave this little NGO enough money to work with 1,000 farm families. 5,400 showed up and joined the program. They didn't ask for any subsidy. They didn't ask for anything free. They didn't ask, the farmers didn't ask for any free fertilizer or seedlings or anything. They just asked, "Can we come and learn?" And malnutrition is on the decrease. And there are no known cases, detected cases of malnutrition in the villages that are working with this little NGO. So people will plant trees in Indonesia, and they will plant a lot of trees. But it cannot be a tree planting activity or tree planting project. It really has to be a multi-pronged approach to poverty reduction, to solving their most pressing problems first. And only after the most pressing problems, such as high interest rates, malnutrition, low farm gate prices. Why are farm gate prices very low? Well, we've all heard of monopolies, right? We all hate monopolies. Monopolies are just by nature bad. Well, there's a flip side of that that is very often not understood. It's called monopsony. Now, we understand monopoly because it might affect us as a consumer. You're in a country command economy, and there's only the brown shoe company that produces brown shoes, and it's the only one authorized by the government. And that's a monopoly, a government-enforced monopoly. And the brown shoes are poor quality, high price, don't last very long. Monopsony is the opposite. Monopsony means only one buyer. You can have lots and lots of farmers producing. You can even have the appearance of lots of collection traders coming out on their motorcycles or in their pickup trucks to buy. But if they've all agreed on only offering one low price in the city before taking off in the morning, then you're facing a monopsony. So what did the NGO do about monopsony? They actually just got these people to get together and go down to the various neighboring towns and try to find different assembly traders. And if in the nearest town, and if in Kefa Mananu, there's a monopsony going on, and the buyers are only willing to offer a very low price, drive over to the next town, drive to Soe, or drive up to Atambua, and find a trader there, and get together a whole truckload of goods, 3 tons, and rent a truck, and take your own stuff to the big town. And farm gate prices rose 10 to 15%. At 10% of a very low number, but 10% meant a lot to these people. Collective marketing. So the NGO worked together on solving the most pressing problems first, and then got around to the introduction of this new sloping agricultural land technology. Not everyone in Indonesia is a forest cutter. There are some people who are willing to plant. And when they plant, they will plant large, significant numbers of trees. Thank you very much.